I think it's apparent when this building was built in 1911, the architects thought that nobody would hitch up their horse and ride to the city of Pier to hear a Supreme Court oral argument. Thus, the seating capacity is somewhat limited, but I'm pleased that everybody was able to get in. So, with that, the third case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota Appellant versus Wayfair, Inc., Overstock.com, Inc., and Newegg, Inc., Appellees. For the State of South Dakota, we have Attorney General Marty Jackley and Mr. Richard Williams, the Deputy Attorney General. Attorney General, I understand you'll be presenting this morning.
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. And for the, Appellees, Mr. George Isaacson, an attorney from Lewiston, Maine.
Okay.
You came a long way.
I'm glad to be here.
Okay. And then we also have Mr. Matthew Schaefer from Lewiston, Maine.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. And Mr. Jeffrey Rakowitz from Sioux Falls.
Yes, Your Honor.
And Mr. Eric Citron.
Over here.
Okay. Well, and you're from Bethesda, Maryland. Okay. Well, now that we have all the players identified, we will proceed. And Attorney General Jackley, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, honorable members of the court, counsel. The state appears before this honorable court today and asks for three significant items. First, the state requests that this court affirm the lower court's grant of summary judgment. Secondly, and respectfully, recognizing the busy docket this court has, but to do that expeditiously as practical, to allow the state the opportunity to request the U.S. Supreme Court for cert in the October 2017 term. Lastly, the state is requesting this court, through its opinion, to give a critical and important voice to the U.S. Supreme Court on the granting of cert to reevaluate the physical presence requirement in the Dormant Commerce Clause jurisprudence for sales tax. In 2016, the South Dakota Legislature in Senate Bill 106 put forth an act for the collection of sales tax from remote sellers. That did four significant things. First, the South Dakota Legislature defined or created a substantial nexus to be doing gross receipts in the state of South Dakota of $100,000 or 200 transactions. Secondly, the legislature created the legal mechanism that we're here today, setting forth the opportunity for declaratory judgment, putting in place an injunction once that is filed, which is what happened. Thirdly, the legislature made it clear that there would be no retroactive application, an issue that has been involved in the courts as other sales tax cases have gone up. And lastly, and significantly, set forth in Section 8 certain legislative findings as it applies to harm and the undue burden associated with the national economy. When you look at the jurisprudence setting forth physical presence, we start with Bellis Hess. In 1967, the United States Supreme Court said in its dormant clause analysis relating to the sales tax issues that the state would need to have a physical, there would need to be a physical presence in the state for there to be the tax. Then in 1977, with Complete Auto, a case in which there was a Mississippi tax on motor carriers, the Supreme Court looked at and developed the four-part, call it Complete Auto test. That in evaluating these Dormant Commerce Clause issues, there are four factors. Number one, a substantial nexus. Number two, it had to be fairly apportioned. Number three, non-discriminatory. And number four, fairly related to the taxing activity. At issue in this case is the substantial nexus part, which is so significant.
Has the law changed or the facts since Quill?
I would say since Quill, the law hasn't changed, but the facts have.
So you're urging there's a distinction because of the facts and not an overruling of Quill.
That is correct, Your Honor. In fact, what Quill did is in part overruled Bella Hess. So in 1992, the North Dakota legislature had passed a sales tax not requiring physical presence. The North Dakota Supreme Court had affirmed that based upon Complete Auto. It went up to the United States Supreme Court. And in 1992, that court, when it did the due process analysis and minimum contact, said that due process clause did not require a physical presence, thus overruling a part of Bellis Hess, but left in place, based upon stare decisis, the physical presence requirement under the due process or under the Commerce Clause analysis. Then after 1992 came direct marketing. In 2015, it was a case in which Colorado had passed a reporting and notice requirement. It was a situation where Justice Kennedy took occasion to make clear that based upon changing times, an invitation for the legal process to find the right case, the case to go back to the United States Supreme Court to reevaluate the physical presence requirement. In fact, is that a direct marketing case that went back on remand to the Tenth Circuit, now Justice Gorsuch made clear that Bellahass and that physical presence requirement was an island that is washed away with the times.
Well, back when Quill was decided, I should know this, but I don't, was there an even market, internet market for sales, or what, did you have to send in your order, call it in, or?
Mr. Chief Justice, essentially in 1992, it was and you look at the case of Quill, it was a catalog situation. I look back in 92, I was actually a senior in electrical engineering school. The internet was a concept, not a reality. It doesn't affect things as it does now. In fact, that's one of the significant changes. If you look since Quill, what has developed, and it goes back to the record on the legislative findings, Section 8, Subsection 6, that the software has changed, technology has made it easier, more practical, and more efficient for companies to compute and ultimately collect that sales tax. This case is a perfect example of that. Systemax was the fourth defendant. When the case was filed, they ultimately immediately complied with it, were able to calculate the tax. That's why in this record there's a voluntary dismissal of Systemax. The other things that have changed, if you look at the Streamline Sales Tax Project, in which South Dakota is a part of, the taxing schemes have been simplified. So those are the reasoning and the rationale of why Justice Kennedy has extended that invitation, an invitation that based upon challenging times, that Bellahass's 1967 physical presence test isn't so bright anymore, as the case law has demonstrated, that there become different challenges with computer terminals and other things that may constitute a physical presence, rather leaning towards a more realistic and bright line test, such as what the Ohio Supreme Court recently ruled in favor of in the Crutchfield case, saying that physical presence wasn't required in relation to a business or a commercial activity tax.
As I looked at direct marketing, though, on the remand, Justice Gorsuch's, then Judge Gorsuch's opinion acknowledged and relied heavily on stare decisis. Isn't that the position that we are in at this point?
Justice Severson, that is exactly the position this court is in, which is why I've asked this court on the first point is to affirm the granting of summary judgment in favor of the defendants. But I would point out that Justice Gorsuch made it crystal clear that the Bellahass procedural island is washing away with the times.
You mentioned summary judgment. Can you point to any errors that Judge Barnett made in rendering his decision?
Mr. Chief Justice, no. He did exactly essentially what we're requesting this court to do is, number one, rule against the state, which this court must in order to get it up on cert. Number two, to do it expeditiously, which he did. And number three, in his opinion, he weighed in that while he must rule this way, he made it clear that times are changing. And that's exactly what the state is requesting this court to do. Not seeing any further questions, Your Honor, I would again adopt the arguments made set forth in the brief, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, nobody's ever chastised for quitting early in this court.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
All right. Counsel, you have 20 minutes to present your side of the case. I wouldn't say argue with what he had to say, but I'll let you present your case.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, my name is George Isaacson. I'm representing the defendants in this litigation, and it's an honor to be appearing before you from the state of Maine. One of the things that I think is important for this court to understand is the unconventional, and I think in many respects, inappropriate manner in which the issue has been presented to this court. If we go back and we look at the legislation itself, SB 106, it's a piece of legislation which acknowledges in the findings of fact itself that the statute is unconstitutional. The Attorney General has cited no other example where the South Dakota legislature or any state legislature in this country has knowingly enacted a law in which its findings of fact acknowledge the unconstitutionality of the statute. We believe that's a bad precedent. It's a bad practice. If this was happening in the equal protection field or the First Amendment field, we would all be aghast at it. The Commerce Clause is no less a constitutional principle that not only this court should respect, but the legislature should respect as well. Having enacted this statute, the Secretary of the Department of Revenue then seized upon it to send a demand letter to hundreds of direct marketing companies located outside of the state of South Dakota.
I suppose now it's possible to not even have a presence in any of the 50 states. You could be in Toronto or Mexico City or wherever.
That's absolutely right. And there would be no way to enforce this statute against an out-of-nation country. And under current constitutional standards, not enforceable against an out-of-state company that has no physical presence. What the Secretary of Revenue did was to send a demand letter to hundreds of out-of-state catalog companies and electronic merchants, demanding that they begin complying with the South Dakota sales tax obligation, or if they don't, quote, face the, quote, possible consequences that may follow from non-compliance. And in describing what those possible consequences are, Secretary Gerlich stated that this may result in the state initiating legal action against you. There was no explanation in Secretary Gerlich's letter to these out-of-state companies who otherwise had no connection with the state of South Dakota that the statute was unconstitutional and found to be so by the legislature. And indeed, the legislative findings provide, quote, this is from the legislative findings, it is reasonable notwithstanding this law for remote sellers to continue to refuse to collect sales tax in light of existing federal constitutional doctrine. I think sending this letter to out-of-state companies was a cynical act of intimidation, which was inappropriate. There was no indication to those companies that the findings of the legislature and the very complaint that was going to be filed in this action acknowledged the unconstitutionality of the statute.
But the legislature and the state is arguing that this is under the Commerce Clause and the philosophy of the Dormant Commerce Clause. But isn't that assuming that commerce doesn't change? I mean, we're in an entirely different situation than when the Commerce Clause was adopted. Isn't that something that Supreme Court can and should look at?
Well, if we're talking about the letter that Secretary Gerlich sent out,
I'm talking about the legislation itself.
The problem of the legislation itself, and your suggestion that the Supreme Court, should look at this issue again, is what is the appropriate case for their doing so? This is a case in which there is no factual record at all. So what the state did was to sue three companies, one from Massachusetts, one from Utah, one from California, acknowledging that they had no physical presence in the state, without taking any evidence from those companies regarding what their electronic activities may have been, what the burdens of tax collection would be on them, what the suggested lost revenue speculation on regard to lost revenue might have been, matters that could have been addressed by specific questions posed to those companies, matters that could have been addressed by expert witnesses. Instead, if you read the state's brief, what it does is it relies exclusively on secondary sources, all of which have been hotly disputed. I'll give you an example of that. The state's reliance on these secondary sources is almost exclusively on a study that was done by two Tennessee professors back in 2009, relying upon 2006 data. In 2009, Amazon.com was collecting tax in only five states. Today, Amazon is collecting tax in all 46 states that have sales and use taxes, including in South Dakota. In 2015, Amazon accounted for 60% of the growth in all consumer electronic commerce. So those taxes are being collected. 17 of the top 18 e-commerce retailers collect tax, including collecting tax in South Dakota. These are companies like Walmart, Target, Costco, Staples. They're multi-channel merchants. So what is actually happening is not that this problem, this purported problem of lost tax revenue is increasing. It's actually decreasing as these large multi-channel merchants dominate the field and are collecting tax. Now, that's an important fact. It's a fact not in the record. The 2009 study is not in the record. Similarly, the Attorney General in his brief makes the glib claim that collecting tax is an easy matter. Now, in 1967, when the Bellis Hess case was decided, there were 2,300 sales and use tax jurisdictions. In 1992, when Quill was decided, there were 6,000 sales and use tax jurisdictions. In 2014, there were 10,000 sales and use tax jurisdictions. And today, there are over 12,000 sales and use tax jurisdictions. It's estimated that there's a new local tax jurisdiction being created every day of the calendar year. Now,
all right. Is that, I mean, how pertinent is that to what this issue is? I mean, if you order something from Staples, it pops up in the payout line that you got to pay tax.
So Staples, a very large company, expends, as we indicated in our brief, that setting up a sales and use tax collection format, initial cost is between $80,000 and $270,000, with annual costs ranging up to about $150,000 a year. Now, that may be very easy for Target and Staples. It's not easy for a smaller company that's making only 200 sales a year. And let me give you an example of that. Being in Maine, I'm an avid fly fisherman. And if I decided that I was going to tie flies and put them on the internet to sell at $20 a piece for my famous Pemaquid Wiggler fly, and I sold 200 of those flies at $20 a piece here in South Dakota, so I had $4,000 worth of sales, and with an average tax of 6.5%, that would be $260 of tax that I would owe to the 142 tax jurisdictions in South Dakota. If South Dakota can do it, so can the other 12,000 jurisdictions as well. So the issue, Justice Stevenson, is not the question of can the large retailers, the large multi-channel retailers that increasingly dominate the electronic commerce arena, do they have the accountants and the software engineers in order to do this on a less expensive basis? The problem is that for medium-sized companies and small companies, it's extremely expensive, and it effectively serves as a barrier to entry to the marketplace and will serve as a barrier to South Dakota companies who want to be selling to consumers outside the state and have to comply with those 12,000 jurisdictions as well.
Can't there be an exemption for small companies built into the taxing structure?
Well, the exemption here is if you had under 200 transactions, and that would say to me, be careful to how many people you sell your tied flies to, because once you pass that $4,000 figure, you're going to be responsible for that tax collection. But the point that you make, Mr. Chief Justice, I think is a good one, which is there are issues that relate to how there should be a balance between the interests of the states in increasing tax revenues, even if, as I've indicated to you, that lost revenue figure is a declining one, and the interests of the national economy, which is what the Commerce Clause is intended to address, in maintaining free flow of commerce that is not subject to barriers caused by state taxes or other forms of impediments to the free flow of commerce. What is the appropriate forum for that being decided? The appropriate forum is Congress. And the Supreme Court in the Quill case specifically said that it is preferable for Congress to address this issue, that Congress is qualified to do so under the Commerce Clause, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3. They have the power to regulate commerce between the states. And moreover, Congress has better tools for doing so. Congress can pass legislation that, for example, establishes a minimum that is higher than the 200 transactions that's suggested here. Congress can say, in balancing these interests, The states need to simplify their taxes. The Attorney General referred to the streamlined sales tax agreement. The major problem is that the largest states are not signatories to that agreement. Massachusetts, New York, Florida, Texas, California, Illinois, all are not subscribers to the agreement. The agreement only covers about one-third of the population of the United States. Congress can take those provisions and incorporate them into legislation. And the issues are complex issues. They're not simply issues of different rates. There's different exempt products. There's different exempt buyers. There are questions of sales tax holidays that are inconsistent from one state to another. There are different filing requirements. There are audit requirements being audited by 46 states, as well as the hundreds of self-rule, home rule jurisdictions in the United States. And Congress is considering that very issue. Before Congress right now are four different bills that are considering the issue of dealing with this problem. There's the Remote Transactions Parity Act. There's the Marketplace Fairness Act of 2017. The chairman of the House Judiciary Committee has circulated for consideration the Online Sales Simplification Act. And just on July 25th, there was a hearing held in connection with a proposal that's been presented by Congressman Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin. So it is not as if Congress is not considering these issues. Congress can affect this balance. What the Supreme Court can do is simply make a binary decision. The Supreme Court can either say that we're going to stand by the Quill decision, the bright line test, which the court said gives clarity and assuredness on these standards, or Congress can say the states are free to impose these taxes as they choose. Now, a reasonable question is, why has Congress not acted more expeditiously on these matters? And the principal reason is the recalcitrance on the part of the states to agree to tax simplification. So before Congress, the position that the states take is this is a matter of state sovereignty. We shouldn't have Congress instructing us how to operate our tax systems. We shouldn't have to have any uniform filing or central filing requirement. We shouldn't have to agree to a single audit for remote sellers. We shouldn't have to agree to have uniform definitions of exempt products. This is state sovereignty. But what the states then want to do is have Congress wave the golden wand and allow them to export their tax systems across state lines to impose very considerable burdens on medium and smaller companies. It's not insignificant either that this kind of legislation that takes place is done in an arena in which these out-of-state companies have no true involvement in the political process. They are not located in the states that are passing this hostile legislation against them. They have no employees that are in the state. They become easy targets for the kind of victimization that I think is involved here. The really key element that I think is before this court is the question of separation of powers. Is it the appropriate forum for addressing this issue before this state court, which the Attorney General himself has indicated is really just a way station getting to the Supreme Court? Or is it appropriate for Congress to be engaged in this issue? And the more states have filed actions at the state court level, the less willing they have been to engage this issue at the congressional level. Their view has been, we are seeking reversal of Quill. We don't want to engage in a compromise process before the federal legislature, which is really where the issue should be resolved. If the Supreme Court is going to consider this issue, and we think that the Supreme Court need not do so because of the active consideration by Congress, but if the Supreme Court is going to, it should do so on a full record, a record regarding what is it that these three companies have done. What is their electronic commerce activity? What is their traditional catalog activity? What is the measure of their sales? And on the issue of interstate commerce, what are the real figures? Who are the expert witnesses that should come forward and give testimony regarding the question of what are the burdens associated with tax collection? What really are the lost revenues?
Significant difference between Direct Marketing Association, which was just acted on, where Colorado has a requirement that all of these companies who have sales must report those sales to the state, and the companies under, well, Quill and its progeny and this action, where you would actually be required to collect the tax. What is the difference in burden?
There's an enormous difference, Judge Stevenson, and I'm glad that you inquired that. I argued the Direct Marketing Association versus Bull case both before the U.S. Supreme Court, where it was decided in favor of DMA on a 9-0 decision, including by Justice Kennedy. And it's significant that none of the other eight justices joined in his concurrence, in which he suggested perhaps the court should reconsider Quill in an appropriate case. And I believe an appropriate case is a case with a full record. And then I argued the case back before the Tenth Circuit. All that the Colorado notice and reporting law says is that you have to give a notice that you may be due taxes to your state revenue department. You have to give that with each transaction. So as you check out, there's a little notice that says you may owe taxes. Annually, you need to send to your consumers who made purchases in excess of $500 a letter that summarizes what their past year purchases were so that they can voluntarily submit that to the department. And simply send the names and the dollar volume of total purchases to the state revenue department so that the state revenue department, if it chooses to, can pursue those consumers. That is very different than determining the rate structure in Colorado, especially where Colorado has home rule jurisdictions that have different exemptions for products than the state has, different rates, different exemptions that exist for both purchasers and for products, where the seller needs to make those determinations: what is exempt, what isn't exempt, what purchases are exempt, what documentation for resale certificates are necessary to back that up, where they are subject to audit not only by the state but also audit by the home rule jurisdictions such as Boulder and Denver. That obligation of collection, if there's any failure along the way, then the seller itself becomes liable for the uncollected tax. So that the burdens that are associated with tax collection are extremely different than what is associated with simply giving notice to consumers of their obligation and an annual report of their purchases. The Supreme Court, in cases, has made clear that there's significant complexity that's associated with sales and use tax collection. And in fact, they said so in Quill because of that at that time, 2,300 tax jurisdictions that need to be complied with. One of the leading tax compliance software providers has described the South Dakota tax system as being unusually complex and confusing, in no small part because South Dakota also taxes services. And services present a very difficult issue because in the cloud computing arena, it is difficult to determine where are those services being provided. They can be drawn down in Sioux Falls, or they can be drawn down in Lewiston, Maine. So sourcing those transactions is very complex. The issues here are not easily resolvable. The issues here can be and are being addressed by Congress. This court should not accept the invitation that the Attorney General has proposed, that it be, using the language in the conclusion of their principal brief, should be an advocate for Supreme Court review of this issue. The parties agree, in absolute agreement, that the decision of the Circuit Court should be affirmed. We believe that this court should do that simply by an indication, as the Circuit Court did, that the law is unconstitutional, and therefore summary judgment should be affirmed, without weighing in on what are complex policy questions. Again, I appreciate the opportunity to appear before this court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Isaacson. Mr. Attorney General, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. What the South Dakota legislature did in 2016 is accepted Justice Kennedy's invitation and used Justice Kennedy's words, quote, "The legal system should find an appropriate case for this court to re-examine Quill and Bellis Hess." I would submit to this court that the South Dakota legislature did that. They did that in a very fair, and direct way. I say fair because when you examine the Senate Bill 106, it sets forth the bright line test, $100,000, 200 transactions. It says it doesn't apply retroactively. It doesn't require a defendant to go through the auditing process. Rather, they received a nice letter from the executive branch of the Department of Revenue. I would suggest this also presents the right case for the Supreme Court because it contains very important adjudicated facts and legislative facts. When you look at this case, it came about by defendants moving for summary judgment. And when they moved for summary judgment, they had the right to say what facts they believed were material and that there were no material issues of fact. So the adjudicated facts for summary judgment that are before this court are, number one, that these defendants do not have a physical presence in South Dakota. That, number two, each one of these defendants satisfies that substantial nexus of either $100,000 $100,000 or 200 transactions. And I guess also the fact that they didn't pay the tax and are not paying the tax. Those are the adjudicated facts.
Counsel's argued that the record's inadequate, that it's undeveloped. What is your response?
Two things. It's not inadequate because of those adjudicated facts and because of the legislative findings. My second response would be they either waived it or they're not relevant because they moved for summary judgment. And those facts are not before this court. I know there was a conversation or discussion about the 2009 study. That's a study that Justice Kennedy relied upon. If they don't like it, that's an issue that they should have an opportunity, if cert is granted, to discuss that with Justice Kennedy. But when you look at this particular record, we have very simple adjudicated facts, and we have very simple and set forth and important legislative facts. That's this judicial record. As for whether or not Congress could act, we all know that under the Commerce Clause jurisprudence that Congress has the ability to regulate. And as the United States Supreme Court has said time and time again, they may exercise that and they don't have to. And especially in the absence of them exercising it, the court has that ability and in fact has in this instance. When you look at the Dormant Commerce Clause, that is judge-made law. When you look at the physical presence exception in this case, that isn't made by Congress. That's made by the U.S. Supreme Court, by justices in Bella Hess and Quill. So it is appropriate for the U.S. Supreme Court to do as Justice Kennedy has invited, to reevaluate that justice-made precedence given the changing times. Justice Severson asked the question, what is the difference between what was going on in direct marketing in Colorado with the notice and reporting versus what's happening in South Dakota? And I would suggest that the only difference is this legal island, this island of precedence about physical presence, that certainly when you look at a notice reporting requirement versus a collection and remittance requirement, they are very similar. But what the courts have had to do, given this very small island of physical presence requirement on the sales tax, they've had to carve out exceptions. Legislatures have been carving out exceptions with reporting and notice requirements. In Ohio, Crutchfield carved out an exception with a business or commercial activity tax, which looks a lot like a sales tax. I think it's time to quit carving out or washing away the physical presence requirement made forth in 1967 and barely held on in 1992 based only on stare decisis. Things have changed. The adjudicated facts before this court and the legislative facts, again, go strongly for this court to not be a way station, as been suggested, but to have a very critical and important voice that this is important, that the United States Supreme Court should do what Justice Kennedy and what Justice Gorsuch have suggested and revisit this archaic physical presence and further request that this court weigh in favor of those legislative findings that are before it.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General.
The court will be in recess.